From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour is being made in more than 80 countries and likely every state in this country today. Students are organizing demonstrations of various sorts to call for climate action. In some places, students are walking out in protest of government inaction. In others, students are organizing rallies, pep rallies within the school setting. Some students are organizing after-school events. In our region, we know events have been happening in places like Ithaca, Canandaigua, Brighton. I'm sure we're missing many others. You can share those with us this hour if you like. And this hour, we wanted to let high school students discuss their own views and concerns about climate change. Recently, there's been a lot of debate about whether young students are overstepping. Senator Dianne Feinstein of California lectured a group of students about the need to compromise and be less demanding. But Swedish student Greta Thunberg has pushed back on this idea, saying that adults have failed her generation and time is running out. And she says it's not the time to make everyone feel comfortable. So let's discuss all of that and more with our guests, four high school students, with us here in studio for the hour. Hello to Liam Smith, who is a junior at Brighton High School. Liam, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Radesh Singh. Radesh is also a junior at Brighton High School and a board member of the Rochester People's Climate Coalition. Radesh, welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
You got it. Thomas Neumeyer is a student at the Harley School, a senior. Thomas, welcome to you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And Tess Begley is a junior at the Harley School. Tess, welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
There's a lot to talk about this hour. And listeners, if you want to share your thoughts, again, on what you're seeing out there or hearing about in school settings, you can email the program, connections@wxxi.org. In many ways, we want to let the student voice kind of push this conversation. And I want to go around the table and just start by asking what this day sort of means to you. You know, Radesh, there's a lot of talk about either action or inaction. What is your hope that as you look around the world, as you look around your county, as you look at schools with different ideas about what's going on today, what do you hope comes out of a day like today?
Out of a day like this, I would hope that students, high school students and other youths get inspired, that they're inspired to take change, to agitate for reform, for change not only at the local level but the national level as well. Recently, my peers and I at Brighton High School have been agitating for the Monroe County to pass a climate action plan that would detail what Monroe County would do in the upcoming decades in order to combat climate change. So we hope that youth get inspired by these movements and these strikes in order to take a stand against climate change.
And what happened at Brighton High School today? Something already happened.
Yeah, today, actually, we just an hour ago, we had a pep rally called Our Climate Pep Rally, where we had about over 100 students come to the gym. They signed petitions in support for this Monroe County climate action plan, and we had a rap battle as well. We had some wheelbarrow races and just a fun setting for students to come and share and just agitate for climate reform.
Liam, are you satisfied with what you're seeing from government leadership here, this country, maybe around the world on the issue of climate change?
I'm definitely not satisfied with what we're seeing right now. I will say that I'm satisfied with what my school is doing. The Climate Club, actually, we presented to our school board as well as our environmental committee and our student senate this past December. And our school board has agreed to create a climate action plan to reduce greenhouse gas emissions throughout our school district. So I will say that's one place where we are satisfied with what we're seeing, but we'd like to make sure that we follow up with our school board and make sure that they do have a progressive climate action plan.
And when you look at, I mean, literally at the federal government, the state government, if you're not satisfied, why do you think and I don't say this in a way to sort of patronize, I'm just very curious here, why do you think the adults who've been running in the halls of power have failed in your eyes? Why do you think people aren't getting things done?
Why aren't they getting things done? Well,
I guess I'm asking,
a lot of people are uneducated.
Do you think they take this seriously is what I think what I'm asking, yeah.
I don't think they're taking this seriously. I mean, there's been a lot of misinformation, so a lot of people don't really know about climate change, but part of it may be due to the fossil fuel industry and the oil lobbyists in Congress. Our government definitely needs to take a step up and start doing something to address climate change because Trump is trying to withdraw from the Paris Climate Accords, which were non-binding to begin with. But still, that just shows that our government isn't really concerned about climate change and we need that to change.
Tess, are you satisfied with what you're seeing in terms of government action on climate change?
No, I'm not. I think we have yet to see any sort of definitive action and any real change in what's happening in the world. I don't think the government is doing enough to stop or even just ameliorate the effects of climate change.
Why do you think that government has failed to do that?
Well, like Liam said, I think there's a lot of misinformation going around about climate change. And again, the fossil fuels industry is definitely a big factor.
Okay. Thomas, are you satisfied?
No. Yeah, I'm not. We've seen movements, and we've seen people saying things like that there's been a lot said about it, but I feel like there's not been enough concrete action, and even sort of these non-binding accords have kind of come short of seeing any meaningful change in some places, especially when they're non-binding and we see people pulling out of them. I think locally we have seen good movement, especially just grassroots. That's obviously not governmental, but we've seen groups, RPCC, RYCL, which I'm a part of. We've seen movements come up. We just need a reaction, and I think that's what today is about, is getting a reaction from these people and showing that there are millions, billions of kids, probably. I don't know.
That you could see him doing the math in his head. How many
I'm
kids?
I'm thinking, one, seven. There are billions of kids who are going to want this to change, and they need it to change if they want to have a future.
So are there leaders who inspire you right now on the national scene, on the state, and any sort of governmental scene? Can you point to this person and say, this person understands it, this person gets it?
I think, I don't want to sound like a Bernie bro, but I think Bernie has really pushed a lot of that forward, and especially coming from Vermont, a state that has a lot of green energy and also beautiful state. He understands it, and he's pushing for it. And he's obviously not the only one, but he's kind of the one that is in the forefront of my mind right now.
Tess, does someone come to mind that inspires you that's actually working in government now?
Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez and her push for the Green New Deal have been fairly inspiring for me.
Okay. Liam?
So I point to someone who's not in government. I can't really pronounce his name very well. It's like Zuckactical. Do you know how to pronounce it, Radesh?
Oh, God, yes. He was actually recently, Climate Club, we also held a solidarity rally with the plaintiffs of the Juliana v. USA case. And this Native American activist, who I unfortunately cannot pronounce his name as well, he's on the forefront of one of the plaintiffs. So he's been doing a lot of work in terms of agitating for climate reform. And I would definitely agree with in him being a very, very premier voice in terms of climate reform and climate agitation.
Okay.
So he, along with 20 other young people, are suing the federal government for failing to adequately address climate change. And so I really admire what he's been doing. He also uses music to spread the word about how we need climate action. He's a hip-hop artist. And so that's someone I admire a lot.
Well, I want to listen to some of the recent comments made by then 15-year-old activist Greta Thunberg, a Swedish activist who's become sort of an international face, helping lead a movement that says, it's not just that young adults don't have to wait. It's that if adults aren't going to do this, somebody has to speak up and tell them that you're failing us. And that's what she was saying when she was kind of speaking truth to power at the UN COP24 climate talk. So let's listen to some of what Greta said that day.
You only speak of green, eternal economic growth because you are too scared of being unpopular. You only talk about moving forward with the same bad ideas that got us into this mess, even when the only sensible thing to do is pull the emergency brake. You are not mature enough to tell it like it is. Even that burden you leave to us children. But I don't care about being popular. I care about climate justice and a living planet.
I want to return to that line and ask all of you what you make of it when she says to the adults in the room, you are not mature enough to call it like it is, and you have left that burden to us children. Radesh?
I would say that's very, very powerful. And unfortunately, the previous generations have left us with a world that is far more carbon emissions in the air, and a world where we're going to have to deal with the brunt effects of climate change for the past century. So I would definitely agree that, unfortunately, our leaders are inactive in terms of combating climate change and have been inactive for the past many decades.
Yeah, Lynn, when she says, you know, the adults have essentially acted immaturely on this, that I contrast that with that clip of Senator Dianne Feinstein essentially telling the students who had come to see her, you don't get how this is done. I've been here for 30 years. I won by 1 million votes in the last election. I understand how this works. You don't. Slow down. Let's compromise. And I hear Greta Thunberg saying, we have to tell it like it is because you won't. Whose voice carries more weight with you in that?
I mean, in my opinion, Greta Thunberg, the youth, we are the people who are going to have to live with the ramifications of climate change. And so I think that the youth voice is really important in this issue, because the old people, I mean,
careful, man. Careful, man. Yeah. I think people, I may be in that category.
You're out. I don't know, you're not that old. But the people who are in office right now, they're not going to see the full effects of climate change. And so I think it's really important to listen to young people like us and like Greta Thunberg, who are concerned for their future and who just want our government to make concrete steps towards a sustainable future.
Yeah. Tess, do you think that teenagers, younger adults, kids right now have more of a moral stake in the argument than older adults, because older adults are, as Liam says, not going to be here as long? I mean, is it a case now where even if we have students who are still learning, high school students, we're all still learning, but high school students are still learning, college students, that their voice has to carry more weight in this particular conversation because they own more of the future, because they're going to be in more of the future? Do you agree with that?
I do. I think that in the future, these people will be burdened with the responsibility of fixing these problems almost inevitably. So I think their voices do carry more weight.
Okay. Thomas, what do you think? When you think on about that sort of that moral calculation, that maybe your generation holds a little more weight there than mine.
I think that's true. I definitely don't want to just count you guys out. I feel like
I'm thrilled to hear that.
That's just throwing you out. I think a big problem is that there's been a lot of denial, kind of saying it's been working fine. So kind of the older generation has seen, I mean, there hasn't been that much bad going on. And so they kind of believe that they'll be able to kind of make it out and that it'll be okay for us. But what we're knowing now, and what we've seen super recently and with the reports coming out, is that it's not going to be fine. And I think that's a big kind of difference there.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Thomas is really touching on an important point here, which is that I think there's a lot mixed into this notion of it's all going to be fine. Number one, it takes a lot of accountability to admit that what you've been doing is really harmful. That's why I turn to some of the people who have, I think, tried to carry this message of responsibility in a way that is as positive as possible while also being real. People like Adam Frank, who is an astrophysicist who argues that for a while we really didn't get that we were doing something that was this harmful. We were unleashing amazing power and creating an amazing civilization, but now we know. Now we know, and it takes a lot to be accountable for that. And I think what I'm hearing from the students in this room and around the world today is it's sort of a challenge to adults to, can you be accountable that you now know that what you've done is not sustainable? And it does require change, even if it's a sort of a radical change. I mean, that's what Greta's saying in that clip, that she used the word emergency brake. Mm-hmm. We often hear this, the comparison that Paul Hawken and others have made, that if you're in a car going 60 miles an hour toward a cliffside, you don't get to congratulate yourself for slowing it down to 40. You have to stop it. And if you don't stop it, but that's where now I want to kind of turn to the other kind of idea that some of our listeners have expressed frustration with, especially as it relates to the way students your age are talking about this issue. I hear from listeners with some routine, and they say, kids act like it's going to be, you know, the world's over in 2030. That's ridiculous. And I try to push back and I say, look, some headlines are hyperbolic. I don't think anybody's arguing the world ends in 2030, that there's like a magically, you know, the sky changes color and everything changes. We're just taking science's cue that if we don't change our emission pattern by then, mm-hmm. we are probably irreparably harming, which means human beings will be on this planet for a long, long time, and it's going to be really unpleasant in a reasonably short order. But I don't know. I mean, Radesh, when when adults are saying, well, you guys are too apocalyptic, that the world doesn't end at 2030, you know, that everybody wants to say that the sky is falling. What do you say to that?
Well, if you look at the science, and then you're referring to that 2018 UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report that I...
Thank you, Radesh. I did not have that in front of me, but he did.
Of course. Yeah, the IPCC report. And the report found that by 2030, because of the emissions that we're releasing into the atmosphere, the average temperatures will rise by 1.5 degrees Celsius. And because of that, we will be pass a point where we won't be able to reduce the effects and we won't be able to mitigate the effects if we continue down this path. So if you, and this is not the only report, there have been reports by many governmental organizations and governments in the past decades that have been showing how if we do not take a stand against climate change right now and take concrete policies in order to reduce the effects of climate change, we are going to experience a world where the results will be devastating. And obviously, it's really unpleasant to think about, but we have to take that step one step at a time. So,
okay. Liam, what do you think when you hear adults saying that your generation's being a little on the apocalyptic side, you know, that the rhetoric is over the top, et cetera?
To some extent, they're right. The world's not going to end in 30 years if we don't do anything about climate change. But what is going to happen is that as temperature rises, glaciers are going to melt. So that will get rid of a water source, a clean freshwater water source for many homes. Sea level is going to rise. That will flood many coastal cities, which happen to be, there are a lot of coastal cities because they're good ports. And so that's going to affect everyone's economy. And what you do to fix that, like do you move or do you build seawalls? Either solution is going to be really expensive. So... there are other things like forest fires. We'll have more forest fires and more severe storms as well as climate change worsens. And so we're just saying that all of these effects are going to result in economic catastrophe. It's not like everything, it's not like the whole world's going to end. It's not like human civilization is going to be stamped out, but life will be a lot tougher and we'd be a heck of a lot better off if we did something about this now.
All right. Tess, what's the message? Too much hyperbolic rhetoric from your generation. What do you say to that?
Well, I agree with Liam. Even if the world is not going to end, we are still, the science that we've seen still indicates that we are going to have some major problems in the future because of climate change. Countries around the equator, I think, have already been seeing the effects of the increased water temperature and rising sea levels and the increased number of tropical storms, and that's only going to worsen as we go further. So I don't think it is out of line to be a little bit worried about that.
Thomas, have you heard anybody, either adults, teachers, you know, other adults in your sphere say, boy, you guys talk about it like the world's going to end in 2030. You know, I've been around a long time, man. You know, calm down here. Have you heard any of that?
I don't know if I've heard that personally.
So you don't hear that at Harley. It's interesting.
I don't think I've heard that. I can see where that would come from, though, definitely seeing that this is almost, yeah, people are kind of blowing it out of proportion, but it's not being blown out of proportion. I think that's also a part of kind of the denial of it, is that when they see, like, oh, crap, this is going to build up really quickly and something could, this could be catastrophic. It's like, that's not going to happen. It's been going fine. And so I think that's just part of the reaction, is that it's overwhelming to know that your lifestyle has been contributing to the destruction of the earth for so long.
Yeah, I think that's hard. I think that's hard for people to get their heads around. But that's why I think we have to try to do it in a way that says, what we have done is an amazing thing. We've built an amazing civilization, but now we understand the consequences, and it is a generational challenge now. That not just, you know, students from your generation, you're not going to be able to do this alone, I don't think. So, I do hope that you are inspiring change. I don't know what that means. Listeners are saying, "Are you picking sides, Evan?" On the policy side, not necessarily. I'm not an expert in this. I do feel the urgency that your generation, and frankly, my generation, a lot of us feel. But the interesting thing is, if you look at polling, I do want to kind of ask you why you think the polling runs the way it does when you ask two simple questions. Is climate change real? Is it generally fueled and being impacted dramatically by the actions of human beings? So over the age of 65, we now have close to two-thirds of over 65 saying, yes, it's real. I mean, that's different than 20 years ago. So that has been slowly changing. But in your age group, you want to guess what the number is? Is climate change real? You know what the answer is?
90%.
It's over 90%.
97?
It's not quite 97, but it's over 90. It's significantly higher than over the age of 65. And then the question is it being driven by the actions of human beings? Or if you're over the age of 65, you're less likely to say that than at least acknowledging that climate change is real. Whereas, again, your generation, it is lockstep. I mean, it doesn't matter who your parents are, what the ideologies in your family are, how you consider yourself politically or ideologically. In your age group, I mean, teenage Republicans and Democrats basically both agree. I mean, they agree, yep, it's real and it's happening and we're causing it. Whereas older adults really don't have uniformity yet on that. Why? What do you think, Radesh?
I think, again, as Liam was saying before, a lot of misinformation in terms of trying to propagate how climate change is not a real thing. It's a hoax created by the Chinese that's coming for our jobs. And that's just like and also misinformation is denialism that comes out of the misinformation, because I think older people, they feel like, oh, it's such a big issue, like it's easier to just deny it and just pretend it's not happening rather than like accepting that it's a fact, it's a scientific fact, and 97% of climate scientists agree that it is happening and we are causing the effects. So I think it's both misinformation and just thinking it's just too big of a problem to handle.
All right. Liam, why do you think those numbers in terms of what different adults of different ages believe, why do you think that gap exists?
So for decades, people have denied the climate science, but I think that one of the reasons that younger people are more likely to acknowledge the reality of the science is that the rhetoric is changing. Climate science is a part of school curriculum now. We talked about in earth science as well as biology, and so it's no longer taught as like a debate, because it's not. And so I think that's one of the contributing factors to why the numbers are so much better for young people.
Okay. It's a great point. Tess?
I think younger people have more access to information about the reality of climate change than older people tend to have. Again, it's being taught in classes in a way that it wasn't before. Plus, through the internet, we have access to a lot of different reports and published works about climate change.
Okay. Thomas?
I think it's also what we had talked about earlier, is about how it's being said that young people have a bigger stake in this, and I think people are just scared. It's like in my lifetime I could see the world change for the worse, and I think that's a lot scarier than someone who's grown up not knowing anything about this and then finding out later that possibly in the next, you know, maybe I won't see it change. Mm-hmm. Like that.
I do think human beings in general, and I certainly would include myself among this, are not very good at dealing with long-term timescales.
Yeah.
You know, we think long-term is 5 or 10 years, when, you know, that is a blink within a sneeze in the universe's eyes, and 100 years is nothing. You know, 10,000 years, was it 10,000 years ago that the glaciers came through and carved out the Finger Lakes? Somebody fact-checked me on this. I think it was roughly 10,000 years. That the roughly correct. I mean, that was nothing. I was down near Finger Lake the other day, and I'm going, look at the landform here. You can literally see, like, at one point there was a physical thing that was like an ice tower that was just running roughshod through. It's just amazing. And then I thought, boy, that seems like, you know, 10,000 years ago. And in the actual time of the universe, it's not. I don't think we do very well dealing with time. And I think, to Thomas's point, it's hard to envision, especially for older adults, that this is happening in a way that is not going to change overnight, but we can notice what it looks like. And for you and your kids and your grandkids, it's going to really potentially change. So let's kind of be a little more specific about your concerns now. For the adults who maybe have some doubts, or, you know, think, look, this is happening, but is it happening this quickly? What are your fears? And I'm not doing this in a way that is meant to be, again, hyperbolic, sensationalistic. I just want to be realistic. Your concerns, maybe, is a better word. What's at the high end for you if things don't change? What kind of world are you concerned about? Is it food stocks? Is it who can live where? What does it look like, Thomas?
I think food and water, especially seeing, I don't know. It's a lot. I think looking at California is kind of a good case study with their problems with water and forest fires. I mean, that just sounds like hell. Having your house burning down and, you know, not having enough, having to ration water. And maybe it's not due to climate change, but it most likely is. And if it is, and that's the world that you're living in, that just sounds, that's terrifying.
So a lot of extremes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tess. Almost like wartime.
Yeah. Tess.
I actually have relatives who live in California, so obviously I'm very concerned about the droughts and the fires that are probably going to become more frequent there as climate change changes the amount of water they have. I don't mean to sound very sensationalistic, but I think it's accurate to say that at some point lives will be on the line.
No doubt about that. Yeah, yeah. Liam?
So obviously personal stories are very compelling, but one thing I also worry about is our economy. I mean, if sea levels rise to a point that Miami and New York City and other coastal cities go underwater, what does that mean for our economy? Where do all those billions of dollars we spent improving infrastructure in cities, what happens to that? And like, how do we combat that? And so I worry about how does our economy cope with that?
Okay, Radesh.
Personally, I'm worried about the instability that might result over a lack of resources in terms of violence that may occur due to competition over resources in places like sub-Saharan Africa or Pacific Islands, or in especially areas close to the equator, and how violence could flare up because of competition over more and more limited resources and water, agricultural land, and the effects on international stability because of climate change reducing the available amount of resources that we have.
We'll be like Mad Max.
Yeah.
We've got a lot of feedback from listeners as we talk to high school students today on a day where students around the world are demonstrating in regards to climate change. More than 80 nations, almost certainly every state in this country. And I want to take our first phone call. Lindsay is on the line to join the conversation. Go ahead, Lindsay.
Hey guys, I just wanted to congratulate you on keeping this conversation going. I'm a 36-year-old and I spent my whole life working on educating people about why it's important to connect with nature and understand it better. And you know, back in the day, I used to go to the climate rallies. I've been to the United Nations Conference on Climate Change back in 2009 at that summit, and I remember coming home from that summit shaking when people would ask me, you know, what I learned and who I met. And, you know, it was at that time people would call me an alarmist, even though I was talking with, you know, the top environmental advisors in the world. I would come home here to little Rochester, New York, and everybody thought that I was an alarmist or I was crazy or I was a tree hugger. And you're not that much younger than I am, you know, but technically I'm older, but I'm not in the category of old person quite yet. So I would guess I'd classify my generation as the linking generation between, you know, those who didn't even know what the word, you know, climate change meant, to your generation where it's a part of what you're, you know, part of your curriculum. And when I was 18, 19, 21, I didn't think that this was going to be an issue that anybody cared about unless you went to school for environmental science. So it's nice to hear you so poised talking about it on the radio, and knowing what you're saying, and using the verbology that everybody can relate to. And I ask you, please, like, keep the fight going, because it's important for all of us to be in on this. And as the younger generation, it's going to be your voices that we have to listen to. So thank you. Thank you for keeping it going for all of us.
Thank you, Lindsay. Thank you. Yeah. Powerful stuff there. Probably pretty affirming for the students in the room here, students from the Harley School, students from Brighton High School, and just two schools among a list of local schools that is addressing climate in various ways, in their classroom settings, with discussions, today with a pep rally at Brighton. I said, is that the right term?
Pep rally,
yeah. It was a pep rally.
It was.
Okay. There's talk of an event after school at 12 Corners, which it's mildly mysterious to me, but around sometime around this afternoon, you might see people out there. We know we've been hearing about events in Canandaigua, Ithaca, all across the region, across this country and in more than 80 countries around the world. After our only break this hour, we're going to come back with the students in the room, Ritesh Singh, Tess Begley, Thomas Neumeyer, Liam Smith. And I've got some emails I want to read for them with some of their some adults who are weighing in with questions on how they would address certain things. And so I think it's great to continue to hear the perspective of the students who have such a moral stake in what's happening in regards to climate and climate policy. We continue next on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, the Rochester Music Hall of Fame gets ready to celebrate a new class of inductees. We'll run down the list for you, and we will talk about who's in, who did not get in, what some of the critics say about how the process works, and the mission of the Rochester Music Hall of Fame, which has expanded in recent years. We'll talk all about it next hour. Connections continues here on your member-supported public radio. I'm Evan Dawson. All right, so some feedback from listeners. Diane writes to us and says, I sat at a restaurant last night and listened as the folks at the next table to me discussed how fake global warming is. I'm surprised I didn't taste blood as I bit my tongue. One of the toughest things today's youth face is closed-mindedness. It's people making their decision about climate change without study. Heck, even the president ignores his own government-mandated reports. Today, I regret that I didn't say anything. I could have told them how my son, an East Rochester graduate, spent 8 years in higher ed to become a climate scientist. He wouldn't have wasted that much time, effort, and money on something that was proving to be false. It wouldn't serve him to present false data. The data is what it is. Like Greta said, this is black and white. That comes from Diane. Now, she says she regrets not saying anything, and she's curious to know if you would have said anything. I am curious about this, and I'll start with Ritesh on this, because to some degree, as you said, you know, the there's a moving on that's happening. Mm-hmm. And I will be blunt. We rarely will take a phone call anymore if we know someone's calling in to say, well, climate change is fake. Mm-hmm. I find that to be mostly a waste of time. And I don't mean to be rude about the fact that some people actually believe that. I would like to speak to them separately. I don't want to sort of waste the airtime with this program with that, because I think that's a waste of time. But if people want to email separately, if they even want to chat, I'm open to that, because everyone's mind can move. My mind can move. I believe that everyone's mind can move. But I don't take calls with that. Would you have said anything, or do you think, look, I don't have time for this? Would you, if you, next time you're at a restaurant, you hear somebody at the next table talking about this, would you say something?
That's a tough decision. I think it would also depend on like where you are,
You're
feeling. You know, if it's a good day, then maybe. But
do I want to ruin this good day?
But I think it depends on. It all depends on how you approach it, because I think if you attack climate deniers, that just makes the whole conversation worse. You're closing the conversation before even having one. So I think if I'm able to like come with the right mind and say like, hey, here's the data. Not attacking you, but this is what it is, and facts are facts. I think I would, but I think the best way is just go about it calmly and not go in an attacking manner.
Now this is going to sound patronizing, but I have to ask, is it disappointing as you get older to realize that just presenting data doesn't usually work?
Unfortunately. But I think you got to keep trying. Uh-huh. And I think the best way is to show the local effects of climate change and how it affects you directly. Like right here in the area, how rising temperatures is going to cause more precipitation in terms of precipitation during the winter, and as well as agricultural drought, and in terms of the effects on the wine industry and the Finger Lakes, for example. So keeping it localized, in a level where people can understand, and just presenting the data very in a very unbiased way. I think that's the best way to go.
Okay. Liam, you think you'd say something?
I would probably say something, but I agree with Ritesh. Never attack a climate denier. That's what we've done for a long time, and it doesn't work. they will just say, yeah, it's those darn libbies. They're just being jerks. So I think what we need to do is just present the data, point out the statistic that 97% of climate scientists agree that climate change is caused by humans, and then just let it be.
See, that's an interesting point. If they think that they're just there to own the libs, as you could say, 90% plus of people our age believe this. And that means Republicans, Democrats, liberals, conservatives, people who identify from all parts of the spectrum agree on this. So you can't just own the libs anymore.
Yeah, and that's an important point, because at this point, if we're going to get anything through Congress, this needs to be a very bipartisan approach. Climate change does not have to be partisan, and I don't think it is a partisan issue. I'm a part of a group called Citizens Climate Lobby, and their approach to climate change is a revenue-neutral approach, which appeals to Republicans, and that's something that I think is really important because we're not going to get anything done without Republican support.
Okay. Tess, would you have said something?
That's a great question. I think there is definitely a difference between debating a climate change denier in a situation where you both have agreed to talk it out mm-hmm. and just sort of walking up to some random people and sort of butting in on their conversation. So I don't know if I would say anything simply because they didn't really ask.
That's a really wise point, because that's not necessarily a sign that their minds are open to it. They might feel like, whoa, you're parachuting in here. Who are you? But you're right. I mean, it's a different thing if you're having a conversation in good faith with someone who disagrees, mm-hmm. at least on the grounds that, hey, let's talk about this. Yeah, that's a very wise point. Thomas, what do you think? Would you have said something?
Yeah, I don't think I'm confrontational enough to make a move. I'm not to say I'm passive, but I'd be a little afraid. I knew someone who was a climate change denier, and I honestly don't think I ever talked to them about it. I just kind of avoided the subject. But yeah, I was watching a video about anti-vaxxers recently, and sort of the debate. There was a video where they had anti-vaxxers and pro-vax, well, other people basically, sitting next to each other and debating the topic of vaccines. And something someone brought up was that the pro-vaccine people were just kind of throwing, like, it's one in a million, there's not risk there. And then the vaxxers, the anti-vaxxers, were bringing up their personal stories. And that was kind of the better arguments were the ones that combined the two. So, like, the personal or mm-hmm. the more deeply affected cases and the statistics. And so, yeah, I think it's hard when you have this, the issue of climate change, which is one that's, it's when you're talking about 50 years in the, or 20, 30 years in the future, things happening, and you're backing, it's hard to back it up right now with more than statistics. It's hard to make the argument, but I think now we are seeing the effects, and now we're getting to the point where we can combine these statistics that in 20 years, it's going to be irreversible. Plus, we're seeing that already happening. Mm-hmm. We can make, it's like, there's a compelling case to be made.
That's a great point. A lot of the times we talk about when we are trying to put together powerful conversations on the talk show, we want data, mm-hmm. we want information, and we want personal stories. There are times, I think, in journalism, we over-rely on personal stories because sometimes they're so emotional, they're so salacious, and I think they can be very effective if they're underpinned by the data.
Yes.
And Thomas's comments there are a really good reminder of that, and probably something that someone like myself and a lot of journalists should keep in mind. Jane in Rochester wants to jump in with us next. Go ahead, Jane.
Yes, I'm real glad you have younger people on. I'm one of the older people, and I'd like for us not to be in any way polarizing with the young and the old, because there have been a lot of active older people. And I remember myself way far back with Rachel Carson trying to get people's attention about DDT. But with Feinstein, I don't know what's wrong with her. It seems like she's got a conflict of interest there, because if I recall, she's connected to the defense industry so heavily. And I would say to the young people there that some of the older ones of us, we're catching on now. But there's been so much inaction. We need more people involved, young, old, or in the middle. So come one, come all, if you're interested, would be a better attitude, not to alienate people. But there does seem to have been just a passivity, a maddening passivity. And the politicos, well, I think we've counted on them way too much. They're very attentive to what corporate interests are and what corporate America wants. And they put that above, it seems, anything else. But kudos to you, Evan, for having these young people on. They're great. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Jane. No kudos to me. Kudos to them. This is a I always appreciate hearing from students and their perspectives on this. And I think this hour, as you hear the students from the Harley School, from Brighton High School, talking about their views on climate, I think we're listening. We need to be listening. So Jane's, one of her points is just be careful not to kind of cast this as, well, old people get out of the way, because she says, I'm sort of one of the oldsters, and I want to be with you on this. What would you guys say to that?
I think I made the old people comment. I did not mean to say that all people who are older than me, who are not millennials or Gen Z, are opposing climate policy. There's this group in Rochester called the Raging Grannies, mm-hmm. and they show up to like all the events. They sing their songs about climate justice, and I really admire them for doing that. I mean, into their 60s, 70s, 80s.
Yeah, they're like the Raging Great Grannies now. and they're doing it. They're doing it. They're doing it. No, I think that to Liam's point there, I didn't, you know, we can laugh a little, and I think Jane probably takes it the same way. I think she's just urging a little caution not to overly starkly divide it. But, I mean, I think the point is being made here. If you just look at who is invested in different ways, there is a little bit of a split in polling, in belief, in desire to see policy move. So, but that doesn't mean, Jane, that they're casting on everybody. I certainly don't think Radesh thinks, hey, this is our generation's fight. See y'all later.
I mean, no, obviously not. The whole conservationist movement, it started with in the 60s and 70s on the backs of the old generation right now. Well, I mean, not old, but...
Oh, my God.
The later generation.
The baby boomers. And because of them, the modern-day conservation movement that we're now leading, that I would say we're on the forefront of that right now, it was based on the actions that they took 50 years ago, and they're still on the forefront right now. You see leaders in Congress and in the world that are elders and part of that generation that are still agitating for reform. So this is a big tent, big, it's going to take a lot of effort, and we want all the support, young and old. So.
And I want to key in on something else before I get a little more feedback here, that our guests in studio, the students have brought up, Jane brought this up. She brought up, you know, when she thinks about Dianne Feinstein, you know, is there a money influence there? Who funds campaigns, et cetera? We recently had Harvard Law professor Larry Lessig on this program, who has built his, basically, the last 10, 15 years of his career on a single issue, which is the influence of money in American politics. And to my surprise, he told me he was an optimist, because at least now he says, when you look at polling, doesn't matter the ideology politically, people now believe that money has a controlling influence on American politics. And even as much as recently as 2008, polls showed that people were kind of like, well, you know, it has some influence. He says now it's very firm. People say, okay, well, who funds you? Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter if you're a Democrat, doesn't matter if you're a Republican. Who's funding the campaign, and who are you influenced by? I want to ask all the students, if you tend to agree with Professor Lessig there, do you think about that? When you think about, well, who are the policymakers? We care about climate. What's getting done? What's not getting done? Do you think money is driving this?
Yeah, I take a gov class, and just learning about interest groups recently, and it's really interesting now. There's like the disturbance theory, so that saying that there will be more groups arising as big problems force them to sort of rise up to the occasion, and I think for a long time the oil business, the fossil fuel industry, were the main interest groups that have been funding campaigns. But now that there is this disturbance of climate change being a reality and a imminent reality, there's kind of these grassroots movements that are rising up. And very interesting also how Jane mentioned Politico. I was thinking about that too from Gov class, sort of how the politicians are representing. So whether they're representing their constituents or if they're making their own personal decisions, it's really interesting to see. This kind of sounds maybe like Feinstein might not so much be a representative. Maybe she's being influenced, or maybe that's just how she feels. And I think that's also kind of the problem with calling it the older generation, is that it's more the generation in power, and they can, maybe the older generation can more closely associate with those that are in power because they're around their age. Mm-hmm. And so they're kind of being influenced by these people who are also being represented, who are representing these oil industries or these industries. So it's almost like they're indirectly being influenced by these companies.
Well, Karen in Penfield writes to say, I'm 75 years old, and I don't think your guests are sounding alarmist enough. So here's Karen
saying... We're all going to die.
Here's Karen saying the students in the room are sounding way too reasonable. Karen, I take the point, though. She's feeling the urgency. She says, I don't care what my age is. I feel it. I understand that what the science is telling us. Tess, are you concerned that with the way American politics is structured right now, it's going to be hard to get things done because of the influence of money?
Yes, I definitely feel that way. I think that's been true historically, and it is also very true right now.
This sense, then, I'm wondering if, do you consider yourself an optimist that in 11 years we're going to sit here on this program? I don't know where you're going to be working, what you're going to be doing in the world, but are we going to be in a very dramatically different society in terms of energy consumption?
I'm not typically a very optimistic person, but if I believe that nothing can change, then I won't have the drive to actually try to change anything. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to choose to say that we will have seen some positive change in 11 years.
Okay. Liam?
I think optimism is the driver of the climate movement. None of us would be here today if we didn't think that our government can do something to address climate change. Now, how far will you get? I don't know. My guess is as good as yours. But we're just here to keep raising our voices, inspiring other people to be optimistic enough to make their voices heard. I'm just going to keep hosting rallies, organizing petition drives, and getting all my friends to agitate for reform.
Are you an optimist, Radesh?
I would say yes, I am definitely optimistic, especially with in terms of reform and in terms of change, because change is inevitable. Change has happened throughout our history. Change is the reason why we're here today. And I think people will realize that we're going to be forced to make a change in terms of combating climate change, that will happen. And as Liam says, we're just going to keep fighting. We're going to keep fighting the good fight and continuing to rally and petition for reform. And we are seeing that happening in the local level. So,
And today.
Yes. Our,
over 100 countries.
All right. It wouldn't be a show with teenagers if we didn't have somebody to admonish them on something. Robert in Fairport. Go ahead, Robert.
Yeah, I think that when you're a little bit older, you do get something. You get perspective and things. And I think that if you look back, and I'll look back over my lifetime, in the late 1960s, there was an author called Paul Ehrlich from Stanford that wrote a book called The Population Bomb, said that the battle to feed all humanity is over. He declared this in 1968.
But did all scientists agree with him, though? I mean, that was one guy.
can I continue?
Yeah.
There was a lot of concern over overpopulation at that time. There was a lot of concern that people would be starving, and there were a lot of scenarios that were printed that were very ominous. And this just sounds very, very similar. It's a very similar kind of thing. You want to scare people into making huge changes when, in fact, people adapted to growing populations by learning how to grow food better, genetically modified food in some cases, learning new methods of agriculture and hybridization of plants. So I just question, I'm old enough to remember when the next ice age was the big concern.
Yeah, I got to jump in here. I mean, that's not really a good comparison, Robert. I mean, I take the point on population. There's been a lot of debate about that. But I don't think you ever had 97% of the world's scientists, or whatever the number is, the vast majority of actual scientists who aren't paid by Exxon, saying that, yes, this is the issue. That's the difference now. So, you know, this isn't a case of, I don't think it's a case of students just saying, well, we're going to overinflate this threat and feel apocalyptic. Though you're right, at different times we've been worried about different things. Cold War, threat of nuclear war, all kinds of things. This is a case, though, where the science tells us that the students in the room are not necessarily wrong here, Robert. And I'm with you. As we get older, we get more wisdom. But if for 1,000 miles we were driving a car toward a cliff, And then the last 20 miles, we picked somebody up, and they were like, whoa, did you know you're going towards a cliff? And we were like, dudes, we've been driving for 1,000 miles. We haven't gone off a cliff yet. That doesn't mean that they're wrong. That's what, and that's what, you know, the youngest generation is. So, Radesh, I'll give you the final word to Robert, and I'm trying to be as respectful as I can. He's trying to say you guys are a little overly concerned about this.
I would say we still need to be concerned with this issue because it's still present, but we're still fighting. And even though we might have opposition, we're going to still continue to fight the good fight.
And I also feel a lot of positive energy here. I mean, it is a remarkable group of students here, and this is a small segment of students all across the country and the world who are demonstrating in various ways today about climate. Radesh Singh, Liam Smith from Brighton, thanks for being here. Let's talk again soon.
Thanks for having us.
And our thanks to Tess Begley, Thomas Neumeyer from the Harley School. Thank you both for being here.
Thanks
for having us.
I look forward to future conversations with them. Much more connections straight ahead here.